Well, good morning, everybody, and congratulations on making it out by 8:30 in the morning on the last day of a fairly intensive conference. So I'm going to talk about using early identification tools and approaches for young children that are high risk for mental health problems. A lot of this is really based around the work that I've done for SAMHSA, along with some other partners, to put together a guide called Identifying Mental Health and Substance Use Problems of Children and Youth, a guide for child-serving organizations. What it consists of is four chapters that really outline screening and assessment and treatment for non-mental health professionals, and that kind of are generic across the board, and then supplements that include early education and care and primary care is probably two of the child-serving sectors that are most relevant to very young children. But it also addresses child welfare, juvenile justice, shelter care, schools, and so forth. So that's what you can sign up for. You'd be notified when that is published. It's been a long, hairy trip with two separate editors, and that's why I have that much gray in my hair. So, of course, the earlier that we recognize a child's mental health needs, the sooner we can help. And there's a lot of proven evidence of the value of early identification and intervention for children with mental health and developmental problems. So I'm going to cover approaches that EEC programs and primary care providers can use. I'm going to list some of the mental health screening tools that are appropriate for that age group and that are valid and reliable, and describe strategies for partnering, because obviously child-serving organizations aren't necessarily going to have the specialized intervention resources that are needed. Why early intervention? Young children in pre-kindergarten are expelled at much higher rates than children in school, and primarily for behavior problems that often relate to incipient mental health problems that for which there are very effective interventions using interventions in the school and consistent interventions at home. And there's this horrible statistic that 70% of children with significant developmental and behavioral difficulties enter kindergarten without their problems being identified. So there's a lot of room for improvement here. We worked with SAMHSA and also a number of other federal child-serving organizations, including the CDC. Ruth was on the team, and one of the things that they developed to guide the project was a set of principles for early identification. First was do no harm. Second was informed consent, that screening should be a voluntary process. There should be clear written procedures that guide child-serving organizations in getting parental consent from parents, guardians, or the foster care system if the child is in legal custody. And that the process should be scientifically sound, and it should use valid and reliable tools, be developmentally appropriate for age, gender, and culture, respect and take into consideration cultural norms, which is particularly important for young kids, where child-rearing practices can differ considerably between cultures, and so the meaning of certain behaviors can be very different. For example, if it's routine for a culture to hand feed a child way beyond the ages that we customarily do, it's going to look as though the child is more dependent than in fact it is, because that's actually a normal practice. And it should be administered by people that are appropriately trained and qualified. It's important to safeguard information, and this may require not so much in primary care, but in early education and care, separate kind of record keeping for this kind of sensitive information. And you also want to avoid implicitly identifying the results of screening by, you know, having positive screening people go in one direction and negatively in another. So it's just something people need to be sensitized to. And absolutely, there's no point in screening if you don't have linkages to assessment and treatment. That's one of the things about Do No Harm is set it up so that people can, that families have the option to get the follow-up services they need. And emphasizing that screening is not a diagnosis. It identifies the possibility of a mental health problem, and it doesn't absolutely determine that it is. And premature labeling is just not helpful, especially at very early ages. So babies can show signs of depression. It's not usual to think about infant is having mental health problems, but they do. And approximately 13% of infants have mothers that are depressed, and that may negatively affect their ability to parent and affect the child's development. Many mental health problems are related to a lag in the child's development, and they can inhibit a child's age-appropriate abilities to communicate, relate to others, and control their own emotions and behavior. And these are all skills that they need to be able to move forward in life and succeed in early education and care and school. And the opportunity to intervene early and help children start to learn these skills is very valuable. And much of a child's development occurs in the context of relationships. And so most of the interventions for infant mental health are not individual therapy, but working with parents and other caregivers to help to appropriately meet that child's needs in order for them to maintain development. So I just talked about that. And there's proven advantages to intervening. Those who receive early intervention services for developmental social and emotional problems are more likely to complete high school, live independently, maintain productive employment, avoid pregnancy and criminal behavior. So there's an incredible payoff to this. So we're focusing on primary care and early education and care. Obviously, primary care providers see very young children often quite frequently, at least annually and often more. And 43% of two-year-olds are in full-time child care and 32% of one-year-olds. So very high proportions of children are seen in that sector. It's imperative to include families, especially at this young age, because caregivers have to be involved. Pediatricians certainly have a special role in working with families in a whole context of trust that they can build on to address problems that are perhaps more sensitive to families or harder for them to understand. And early education and care providers often have insights into the challenges that the families and kids are facing in their own community, often maybe part of that community and understand the culture, and often have a trusted relationship with the family that they too can build on. Few parents are familiar with the concept of social and emotional health for a very young child, and using that terminology may be an easier way to introduce it than infant mental health would be, is it's easy to buy into wanting to foster appropriate development. And they certainly have very important information about their child's normal behavior and challenges, and in fact, teacher and parent informant tools are basically the tools for this age youth. It's about observing how they behave. And of course, they have they're the ones to make the decisions. To get the services needed for intervention, there are some opportunities for partnerships with local mental health providers. And it's more and more common for early education and care programs to have mental health consultants that can come in, observe children, work with work with teachers on managing behavior in the classroom, and talk to parents. And with parental consent, they can sometimes work with individual children. So here are just some referrals to community mental health centers. Head Start, which is required to address behavioral health problems and do screening. SAMHSA Early Childhood Grantees, and Caring for Every Child's Mental Health Campaign, the collaborating organizations. So I'm going to need to speed up. So why would you use a screening tool? They have incredible advantages over an informal primary care interview. They're often shorter than a conversation would be. They ensure that mental health problems are addressed. They signal to parents that this is an appropriate place to raise these kinds of questions. And they can help a physician to introduce sensitive issues. They can help non-professional, non-mental health professional child care teachers to objectively evaluate what they're observing. So selecting a tool, it should be appropriate for the age and the kinds of problems you're concerned about. And I'm not going to talk to you guys about validity and reliability because I think you know. Considerations about how much time, the cost of the tool, who can administer it, all of these, and certainly literacy and fluency are big considerations, and the cultural beliefs and values of the service. So, So we developed a short list of screening tools with some clinical professionals that meet these standard criteria for reliability, validity, and having been used in a demonstrated feasibility for use in these settings. Most don't meet the criteria of cultural competency, which was desired. When a tool is used with a culture for which it hasn't been tested and validated or normed, the results shouldn't be considered to be fully valid. However, administering the tool can open a conversation that can help you understand what is the meaning of, you know, the scores that maybe a child has flagged indicators of problems. What does that mean to the parent? How do they interpret that behavior? So it can still be useful, but it should be used with a lot of caution. So these are the tools that we identified as best practice tools. These are not, these shouldn't be considered a limiting factor, but we wanted to simplify for non-professionals three tools that they could count on that would have broad applicability to this age group. And actually there's also a sheet on the side that includes those resources and links to more information about the tools. So in implementing screening, we talked about ensuring confidentiality. In administration, you need to train staff. They need to be able to explain to parents what it means, how it will be used, that they don't have to do it, that they don't have to answer a question if they're uncomfortable with it. And it's very helpful where it's possible to get both the parent and teacher observations to have both of those. I think all of those tools have both. And there are certainly limitations in local resources for intervening with very young children. It's a new part of the field. In many places, people are making concerted strides in training in infant mental health. But we would encourage people to look for that, and also to look for support from parent and family organizations, which are very important resources and very well connected to the resources that are there. I think primary care physicians who have been discouraged in the past about the kind of resources will probably find a group of mental health providers that are more responsive to children and their families, more community-based, and more aware of the need to collaborate with medical and other providers than they were, say, 10 years ago. And certainly EPSDT is another opportunity. Medicaid requires its programs for children to have set up, for states to set up periodicity schedules, and they have to address behavioral health screening in those schedules as well as standard medical health. So there are opportunities to incorporate more validated screening tools into that. And there's a link there. And of course, IDEA is another big resource for children that have more serious problems, especially in states that that allow for social and emotional delays to be a reason to be included. Voila.